Are you seeking a Rocky Mountain High medical education? Want to know how to get into the University of Colorado School of Medicine? Tune in. Today you'll hear from its Assistant Dean for Admissions and Student Affairs.
Welcome to Admission Straight Talk, the podcast dedicated to graduate admissions and helping you approach the application process thoughtfully and successfully. Your host is Accepted's founder and world-renowned admissions guru, Linda Abraham. At Accepted, our mission is to get you to that unforgettable moment when you read your acceptance email and shout, "Yes, I'm in!" Confident you'll be attending the perfect program to help you launch the career of your dreams.
Welcome to the 359th episode of Admission Straight Talk. Thanks for joining me today. Do you know how to get accepted to medical school? Dr. Susie Schweikert does, and she shares her knowledge and insight in Accepted's free guide, Med School Admissions, What You Need to Know to Get Accepted. You can download your free copy at accept.com/359download. Today's guest, Dr. Nicole Zender, earned her MD at the University of Rochester School of Medicine and Dentistry in 2006. She did her residency in internal medicine and is a practicing physician affiliated with the University of Colorado Hospital. And she's also an associate professor of hospital medicine at, again, the University of Colorado. More importantly, for the purposes of this interview, she is the Assistant Dean for Admissions and Student Affairs at the University of Colorado School of Medicine. Dr. Zender, welcome to Admissions Straight Talk.
Hey, Linda, it's great to be here today.
Thank you for coming. Can you give an overview of the Colorado School of Medicine's program, focusing on its more distinctive elements?
Absolutely. So the University of Colorado School of Medicine is a four-year MD and MD PhD program. We're LCME accredited and affiliated with the AAMC. We offer spots for 10 MSTP students, so 10 MD PhD students in each of our intern classes, and then 174 MD spots. I think there's a few different distinct parts of our curriculum, some which are just blooming on the horizon, which I'd love to feature here, okay, as well as some things that are already in existence. So some of the more notable parts of our school and our curriculum as it exists right now are our longitudinal interprofessional curriculum. So we're fortunate to be on one of the biggest healthcare campuses in the United States. We have our medical school, our dental school, our PA school, our pharmacy school, our nursing school. We have them all here on our campus. And with that, we think that we should take that geographic advantage and have our learners learn together in a true interprofessional environment. That starts here at CU in the first year, continues all the way through the fourth year or the senior year of medical school. So that's one of our really distinct opportunities that our students can take advantage of. And that's true for both MD and MD PhD students. I think a few other parts of our curriculum really deserve a shout out. One is we have quite a few developed longitudinal integrated clerkships in our clinical year. So our students who will be entering in this year's intern class, so the 2020 intern class, have the opportunity to, if they want, participate in five different longitudinal integrated clerkship models. Everything from urban underserved care at our Denver Health site to our CCLIC, which is our rural and community longitudinal integrated clerkship.
How long do these clerkships, well, you say they're longitudinal, so that would be the whole of medical school, right?
So the longitudinal clerkship model is a model that's been done for decades. Here at CU, we've been doing it for about the past 6 or 7 years. And that's done in the clerkship phase of training. So the clinical phase of training, right, which for some schools is the third year. For some schools, it's earlier. For us right now, it's in the third year. And I'll get to that part here in a second. But the students have the opportunity to do the entirety of their clerkship or clinical year at this specific site.
Now, I noticed that the Colorado School of Medicine has a branch in Colorado Springs, though most of your campus is outside of Denver, right?
So our main campus is located at the Anschutz Medical Campus. That's in Aurora, which is east of Denver metro area. Colorado Springs is about an hour south of the Denver area, and we have 24 of our students do their clinical training down in Colorado Springs.
And what is the advantage of that? I mean, why would they choose that? Are they more interested in rural medicine or mountain medicine?
So one might think with Colorado Springs that they may be more interested in mountain medicine or rural medicine, but actually we have students who are interested in all of those things. I think what the big focus on for Colorado Springs is really about the community. for the community, specifically the ability to engage meaningfully in the community and be able to partner with organizations locally in the Colorado Springs area to provide different types of care and to do quality and patient safety in that community. Many of the students who elect to go to Colorado Springs have some sort of tie to that community prior to entering medical school.
Is there a preference at the Colorado School of Medicine for in-state residents?
So what I can say is that we have a higher percentage of students from Colorado, if accepted to our school, that ultimately choose to come here. So students from Colorado, if accepted, are more likely to come to our medical school than students who are from out of state. That said, last year we had a record 10,435 applicants for 184 spots.
Whoa.
So as you can imagine, the vast majority of our pool is actually from out of state. Each year we end up with a class that's around 50-50.
All right. But I mean, many public universities, many state universities have a strong preference for in-state residents. They're very clear about it. They're very open about it. Does that exist in Colorado or not?
We don't have any legislative mandate in terms of number of slots filled. So it can vary from year to year. Sometimes it's 55% in-state. Sometimes it's 50%. So it does vary a little bit. Where I will say this actually isn't a preference from the admissions committee, the in-state tuition is much cheaper than the out-of-state tuition.
Right. Well, that makes sense. Now, I also noticed in preparing for the call that there's something called the Mentored Scholarly Activity at Colorado. What is that and how does it play in?
So some schools, as I'm sure you know, have a research requirement or a senior capstone requirement. We call ours the Mentored Scholarly Activity. Our students, though, come from a hugely diverse background and set of experiences, and we want them to foster that lifelong curiosity in an area of their choosing. So it doesn't have to be a research project. If they want to have a community engagement project or make a focus in the arts and humanities, they're able to do so. They're partnered with a mentor in their first year. And if they don't know who they want to work with, we help figure out who would be a good partner for them. And then they get the opportunity to work on a project that's meaningful to them, most often presents some sort of scholarly output at the end and produce some or create some work, whether it's a written work or an app platform or a community program that is able to satisfy that requirement.
Is this take place during just the didactic portion of medical school, or could it be the whole 4 years? Because you say it starts in the first year.
It starts in the first year. There are some didactic components, but largely this is experiential learning. The students are out in the lab or in the community doing actual work and then come back and present their work at the end of their 4 years.
Oh, wow. Okay. Let's turn to the medical school application. What is the Colorado secondary like?
So the Colorado secondary, unfortunately, I can't tell you the actual question, but I think many savvy applicants utilize Google. They do. So I'm not naive enough to think that it's not out there. The Colorado secondary is one required question, and then optional questions if students are interested in joining one of our tracks or participating in the Colorado Springs branch. The optional questions aren't part of the admissions decision. We just hold on to those, bank those for later. If a student's accepted, then we use that data to help figure out their customized curriculum.
Oh, really?
So it doesn't give an applicant an advantage or doesn't give them a disadvantage if they are or not aren't interested in a track or the branch.
Okay. Now, Colorado requires the CASPER. What does it provide you that the primary, the secondaries don't?
So the CASPER, what we hope to get out of that is a better glimpse into some of the attributes, the non-cognitive attributes that an applicant is bringing into medical school. So as the applicants know, right now the CASPER is scored as a Z score. We get a Z score that's normed compared to test takers at that time. And so we have a sense as to how the applicant did related to the non-cognitive attributes that they were assessing during those video scenarios. And we wouldn't necessarily get that from an essay or from experiences in a way that's standardized and validated.
How long have you been using it, CASPER?
We'll be entering our second year using CASPER.
Oh, so it's still fairly new.
Still new here.
Does Colorado screen secondaries? In other words, are they sent out automatically, assuming that somebody's above a certain GPA in MCAT or without any even automated screening, or is a human being looking at them before they're sent out?
That's a great question. So when I first took this job back in 2014, we were a school that automatically sent secondaries to every applicant who sent us an AMCAS application. I'm a true believer in holistic review. And I don't think that that's fair to either the applicant or the school. If there's a candidate that we wouldn't consider interviewing, we shouldn't ask for their money or their time. So we do some screen. We have some automated features. So students above certain MCAT thresholds automatically get a supplemental application. But every single person who doesn't meet that threshold gets a human review. And the human decides whether or not that applicant would be someone that we would want to send a secondary application to. And we do that every year.
So in other words, whatever that MCAT, is there a GPA threshold also?
There's not.
No. So if the applicant is below the MCAT threshold for the automated secondary, then a human will review the application and make a decision based on judgment.
Exactly.
Whether they should. Got it. Okay. You said, I guess last year it was 10,000 primary applications. I have the data from 2018, which is still pretty impressive. 7,347 primaries, 4,845 secondaries, and you interviewed at that time 642. This is from MSAR.
Yeah, this must be from the 2018 cycle,
yeah,
right?
Definitely 2018. So obviously the numbers are much higher. You can share the ones from 2019, but the question is the same. How do you win it down? What makes an applicant jump off the page for you and be worthy of an interview?
Oh, this is such a hard question, Lyndon. And this is one I struggle with specifically because we have so many qualified applicants. And I think the nature of the beast is that there are some that we'll miss, quite honestly. So that's hard because just of the volume of applicants. Yeah. But getting to your question about what makes an applicant exceptional, I get asked all the time, what is the right formula or what's the magic? What do I need? What are my scores and what kind of activities do I need to do? And there's no one right applicant. What I try and tell our applicants is to be the best version of them that they possibly can be. Most students who are wanting to enter the profession of medicine are kind, altruistic, they're empathetic, they really want to be of service. And I like to see applications that really mirror those values. So if they feel like they're devoted to vulnerable populations, to truly do work with vulnerable populations and to do so in a way that's meaningful and deep and rich over a large amount of time. And when I say large, I mean that they've done this, you know, for a year or more, as opposed to kind of doing these drop-in activities. If you say that you want to work with homeless populations and this is something you're passionate about, I want to see evidence that you've done that and you've done it for a while and you've done it in a way that, you know, is meaningful and that you can reflect on that and know why that experience will make you a better provider in the future.
I mean, it's an excellent point and a beautifully articulated answer. When I ask this question, I'm always reminded, and frequently I get not necessarily so well articulated answers, but similar answers. And I'm always reminded we had at one time, unfortunately, tragically, a very ill child. And there was a playroom where he could go when he went for regular checkups. And there were volunteers in the playroom. And at the time, there was also, you know, you could watch like video cartoons on the wall. It was fine. And there was this one volunteer in the room. He just sat there and watched the video cartoons. He didn't interact with the children at all. Mm-hmm. He didn't do much of anything. And you knew that all this guy was doing, at least I knew, all this guy was doing was checking off the box for volunteering. That's all he was doing. And you knew also he was not going to get a recommendation. I knew, again, I don't know that he knew. He clearly didn't think so. He was essentially wasting his time. And checking off the box is not what you want to be doing.
No. And in fact, we don't have in our screening rubric, we don't have those sorts of boxes. And I think there are schools that may say you need to volunteer for this amount of time or you need to shadow for this amount of time. But every applicant comes with their own unique story and their own unique passions. And I would much rather have an applicant who is able to dive deep into their passions and is clear about their values and has the stuff that we need in medicine, as opposed to someone who's checked all the different boxes because that's what they need to get in.
I was checking the boxes more as a metaphor, not as literally.
No, I was using it both ways.
It's an attitude.
Yeah.
It's an attitude. And I'll never forget. This is over 20 years ago. And I'll never forget that guy because it was, you don't really deserve a seat in medical school. All right, let's move on. What is interview day like?
So interview day for us starts with a welcome. Mm-hmm. And I do a quick 15-minute introduction, talking a little bit about the profession of medicine, talking about our institution, explaining the overview of the day, how the day will flow. We then split the group essentially into two halves. We interview 60 applicants on each interview day, and that number is fixed at 60. And so half of the group will go on to do a group activity. And the other half will stay in the room that they're in and get an overview of our curriculum. So the group that's doing the group activity will do something together. I've kindly asked our applicants who've interviewed not to share that, and I think they've honored that. We also have the longest standing honor code in the United States for medical school. So that's something we take pretty seriously. And so I have not seen that activity disseminated broadly. And I appreciate applicants. If you interviewed with us, thank you for not sharing. But what we're really looking to get a sense of is, how do our students work in teams? We're truly a collaborative team environment here. We believe in team science. We believe in team learning. We do a lot of small group learning. And medicine is a team profession now, right? When you're out there practicing, you're working with other healthcare colleagues in a way that you have to be able to communicate with them and play nicely in the sandbox and understand mutual goals and do this all with the patient's benefit at the back of your mind. We're all working together towards that collaborative common goal. So we like to see how they do together. It's short. It's really fun. It actually opens up the day in a quick and really just exciting, fun, innovative way. Then those two groups flip-flop. So the group that was getting curriculum would then go on and do the group activity. After that, the students then have a small group interview, which is for each applicant. They're partnered with two other applicants, different than they worked with previously. And then they have a short interview with two of our interviewers.
Is that more of a traditional individual interview?
It's a little bit traditional, but there's some situational judgment in there. Some kind of, what if you were confronted with this situation? What would you do in this kind of scenario? So half of the group will be doing that. And then the other half is learning about financial aid, learning about our Colorado Springs branch, learning about more of our infrastructure here in our programming. So then they again flip. After that, our students get the opportunity to have a panel with our current students. So we step out of the room and the students drive this. I tell our current students, to be honest, we're not perfect, but it's an incredible place. But it's okay to talk about things that you would like to see changed, because that matters to us as well. Right. They go on a tour with the students, and then they finish out the day with individual interviews. So that's one applicant with two interviewers, and that's more of a traditional interview.
So you don't have any MMIs?
We do not have MMI.
Any interest in that or not at this point?
We've explored it. I really like the format that we're doing now. I think it allows applicants to shine from a variety of different backgrounds, introverts, extroverts. I think it gives us the information that we need and is also comfortable and fun for the applicant.
You focus a lot on this teamwork.
We do.
In your interview day, and the MMI, you don't see that at all.
Right.
You know, so that's one difference. You don't have a lot, but you have some team-based interviews or discussions, projects in the business school world, mm-hmm. because they do also a lot of teamwork, and they can be quite interesting and very revealing. Do you want the students that you admit to have both research experience and clinical exposure?
So the answer to that is not necessarily, but what I will say is that most of our students who are accepted actually do have both. Mm. That's the most common thing. I also recognize, though, that as an undergraduate, particularly if you're working to support yourself or your family, that those are nearly impossible choices, and someone may not get the opportunity to do both in depth. And so that wouldn't necessarily disadvantage a student, but most frequently we see people who have done both clinical work and research work.
Okay, great. And, you know, one question we get a lot now from applicants is go something like this. You know, I submitted my primary, I submitted my secondary, and I haven't heard anything. Should I send in a letter of intent? Do you weigh letters of intent either before the interview or after the interview, or if on a wait list? How do you view those?
We actually don't accept any letters of intent at all or updates. Okay. We take the application as we get it when it's complete with the supplemental and the CASPER. And then we get letters of intent, even though we don't consider them. We kindly thank them or discourage them from sending them. Because the reality is that if we got one from every single applicant in our pool, we would be overwhelmed with just reading these. And the other part of it is we don't know what sort of advice that applicants are getting. So some applicants may be getting the instructions, oh, follow their directions, don't submit anything. And then some applicants may, you know, have connections or may submit those letters. And I don't feel comfortable giving those applicants necessarily a competitive advantage because they sent something in supplemental when someone else may very well want to come here just as bad.
It's interesting because the medical schools vary all over the map in terms of their attitude to those things. So,
okay. And I don't know if there's a right way, but this is our philosophy that we've adopted.
Okay. I think it's, as long as you're consistent with it. So if somebody sends one in, doesn't get this memo and sends one in, then you just ignore it.
We thank them for it, but it doesn't go to the admissions committee. It's not part of the decision either to accept them or not accept them or to have them come in off the alternate list.
And on a forward-looking note, let's say I'm a junior or senior in college right now, or perhaps I've taken a gap year and I'm looking forward to the next application cycle, the 2021 application cycle. What advice would you have for me?
So the advice that I would have would be to apply broadly. We know that our students across the United States are applying to more than a dozen medical schools on average. The other thing that I would strongly encourage students to do is to make sure their application is complete and it's in early. This, you know, should go without saying, but, you know, there's thousands of applicants, and I think you do have an advantage getting it in early and making sure that it's complete. There's sometimes students who wait until the very end, and then even the next day or the day after say, oh, Dr. Zender, I almost made the deadline, but I didn't quite. And we don't consider those applications. Sure. I think final other advice that I may have for applicants would be to make sure their letters are truly strong. At least here at the University of Colorado, we would much rather have a letter written by somebody who knows you well than somebody who may be a bigger name and actually doesn't know you well at all. We want to know who you are as a person. We can read the rest of your AMCAS application. They don't need to reiterate your CV. They don't need to tell us about your GPA. We get that from AMCAS, but we want to know about fit. Culturally, will you do well here? Are you the kind of person we want to rotate with on our board teams? Are you the kind of person who would do well in our labs? 20 years from now, are you going to be an alumni who we're proud to say graduated from our institution? And so letters should really reflect those sort of interpersonal qualities.
That's a great point. Thank you very much. What would you have liked me to ask you?
Gosh, I'll be honest, I'm not a podcast expert.
So but is there something about the Colorado Medical School that, you know, you would really like a listener to know about, either in terms of the program itself, the culture, or what they should be thinking about when they apply?
So a few things. So one about our program, we're right now undergoing curriculum reform. We're doing some really innovative things. So the entering class of 2021 should be on the lookout for a newly launched website. But as a sneak peek, we're doing what a lot of schools around the country are doing. We're shortening our preclinical phase so that we can get students into the clinical environment earlier. We've made the decision to move USMLE Step 1 until after the clinical year, particularly since the eight schools that did this initially found at least, if not better scores, less anxiety around USMLE Step 1. So I would want students to know that coming into our curriculum. The other thing that we're doing is we're moving towards an all longitudinally integrated clerkship year for our entire medical student body. So we'll be the first school in the nation who truly is an all LIC model.
And that means that they have clinical exposure throughout?
So in the traditional model, when students do their clinical year, they'll do surgery, then OBGYN, and then maybe pediatrics. Mm-hmm. The students here really get the opportunity to do patient-centered care. And on any given day, they may be in OBGYN and the emergency department and rounding on the internal medicine wards in a way that they can facilitate both longitudinal relationships with preceptors, but more importantly, with patients. And so say, for instance, if I was the patient and I went in to the hospital and I needed my appendix out, my student who, you know, I saw in primary care clinic would be alerted that I was in the emergency room. Then maybe when I went to surgery, they would scrub into the surgery, see me in the hospital after, visit me postoperatively, then go to my surgery follow-up. So it allows for the student really to get to know the patients in a meaningful way across the year.
Got it. And obviously, if there was something more serious than appendicitis, you'd have more opportunity to see the patient.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think the other thing that I would want students to know is how welcoming our culture is here. We truly want every single one of our students to succeed. And they're like family. Our doors in our Office of Student Life are always open. We're meeting with students, you know, into the evening, sometimes on weekends. We want to celebrate their successes, whether it's personal or professional, but also get the opportunity to help support them in some of the tougher times of medical school. Medical school is hard, and we don't follow the philosophy that, you know, we're going to weed you out if you're not going to succeed. We want to help create an environment that's going to help you succeed so that you can be the best physician possible.
Right, right. Question on your on the USMLE change. That is that, you know, the USMLE just became pass, fail. Is that going to influence your decision at all?
Our decision in terms of putting it after the clinical year?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
As of right now, the answer is no. I don't know for sure if that will change in the future, but at least for the intern class of 2021,
right,
we'll keep it there after the clinical year.
Okay, great. It was just a thought question that occurred to me as you were talking. And otherwise, the goal of the whole exercise, which is what you closed with, sounds wonderful. So thank you very much. Dr. Zender, I think we're almost out of time. I want to thank you so much for joining me and sharing your expertise and insight into the University of Colorado School of Medicine. This has been just delightful. Where can listeners learn more about the University of Colorado School of Medicine?
So, Linda, our URL is a little bit long and hard to remember off the top of your head. So what I would recommend is that people who are interested in our program, and really everyone who is interested in medicine, visit our admissions website, and you can find that by using Google, if I'm allowed to say Google. You can Google University of Colorado School of Medicine admissions, and we're the first link that pops up. From there, you can navigate to really any part of our medical school, both our clinical departments as well as our research endeavors, and also learn more about the admissions process here at CU.
Great. You can Google, as Dr. Zender said, or just go to exhibit.com/359, because we're going to link to the School of Medicine at the University of Colorado's website, as well as to other resources that may be helpful to listeners. Reminder, you can download a complimentary copy of Med School Admissions, What You Need to Know to Get Accepted, at exhibit.com/359download. Grab your copy today. Listener, thank you too for joining us for our 359th episode. If you found this show helpful, can I ask a favor? Could you leave your feedback on iTunes or your favorite podcast site? It helps us to get ranked more highly. And if you have a website or a favorite social media site or account and mention that in your review, I'm happy to give it a shout out. We have links at exhibit.com/359 to prominent podcatcher pages, including iTunes. It's super easy to leave that review, so please feel free. This is Admissions Trade Talk, produced by Accepted, and I'm your host, Linda Abraham. I'll talk to you again next week.